Morning, everyone. I feel like we should be in a grand cathedral with that music tonight. Will you please join in prayer with me? O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Dearest Mother. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all imperfections. Give me bliss in thy presence. Give me joy in my heart. Give me love for all mankind. Be a constant and abiding presence. In body, mind, and soul. Now and forevermore. Peace. Bliss. Amen. I'd like to read to you from an email that I sent out to us this morning to all dear friends. My dear friends, my father left his body this early morning, December 30th, 2007. He left the body resting peacefully, the fulfillment of a long and fruitful life. Due to a childhood illness, he had an enlarged heart. This did not seem to slow him down even a bit through most of his life. The doctors did know where there would come a time when it would create a difficulty. When I was at first at Anandashram 10 years ago, he had a triple bypass surgery. He did very well overall, though he had times of feeling weak and would need some days of rest. In the last 6 weeks, his condition has rapidly declined. Yesterday, blood tests indicated that his kidneys had shut down. This AM, he left the body. I thank you for the prayers said on his behalf. I know, given his physical condition, he would not have wanted to continue. I knew this when he only stared at the sports pages and could not digest them, that his time was soon coming to an end, and that he wouldn't want to keep going on. Please keep my mother in your prayers for peace in a time of sorrow. During the night, I meditated upon my father. I saw him with the inner eye, and he appeared in his early 20s, tall, lean, and an easy smile upon his face. No longer was he burdened with a body that had served him well, but had given out. The smiling, easy form is what I see now any time I think of him. May he know continued joy in his new life. With deepest love and blessings, David. And from Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, this is verse 13 of chapter 2. Krishna speaking. As in the body, the embodied self passes through childhood, youth, and old age, so is its passage into another body. The wise thereat are not disturbed. Master's commentary. The ego is continuously conscious of itself in childhood, youth, and old age. The embodied soul is uninterruptedly conscious. Excuse me. Excuse me again. The embodied soul is uninterruptedly conscious, not only in infancy, adolescence, and old age, but also of its series of lives and deaths. The ego's alternations between the physical and the astral worlds. The soul perceives all the bubbles of states of consciousness floating in the past, present, future river of time. The ordinary man, without serving his senses, sense of I-ness or ego consciousness, gradually perceives the states of infancy, youth, and old age. A sage perceives the series of lives and deaths to be different experiences in an uninterrupted consciousness of soul perception. This is very important here. The ordinary man, without severing his sense of I-ness or ego consciousness, gradually perceives the states of infancy, youth, and old age. A sage perceives the series of lives and deaths to be different experiences in an uninterrupted consciousness of soul perception. A mortal does not experience a prenatal or post-mortem continuity of consciousness. He therefore sees a dark past and the future as unknown. But a meditating devotee shifts his consciousness from the changes of birth and death to the changeless being in whose bosom all changes dance. He beholds all prenatal, postnatal, and postmortem changes without being emotionally affected by them. This unattachment ensures the devotee of an everlasting, changeless happiness. Those who are engrossed in change delusively expect permanent happiness from the changeable sense world. The wise do not expect to reap everlasting happiness from friends, beloved family, or dear possessions. The forms of loved ones are snatched away by death. Material objects turn out to be meaningless when one becomes used to them, or when, in old age, the senses grow unappreciative, powerless. Concentrate on the immortal spirit through meditation, and find there a harvest of eternal, ever-new peace. These are wonderful words from Master. And there's a lot that's contained in them. We all have a sense, as we grow older, of the sense of I-ness that exists inside of us. We know that there's a sense of sameness, that if we think back on our life, when we are perhaps in elementary school or even younger, and then we transfer our thoughts to a time in middle, junior high or high school perhaps, and then we continue forward into our life. At various times, we take samplings. And if we were to focus, particularly at the heart center, we would say, who am I? And the sense of I-ness would remain the same in any one of those stages of consciousness, whether we were young or middle age or older. And so the consciousness continues unabated. It continues the same throughout. Now, when we are relegated in body consciousness to this human consciousness, to this body, then we don't experience what happens before birth. We think about before birth, and it's a complete blank to us. And so we think, perhaps, that our life, our consciousness, began exactly when our birth began. And so, too, with thinking beyond, where do we go to beyond this life? Now, perhaps if we have read some books about heaven and an afterlife, we may, through imagination, begin to create some ideas, some ideals. I remember when I was a boy and I asked my mother, I said, when I'm in heaven, do I get all the candy that I want to get to eat? And she, being a very nice and supportive person, says, yes, I imagine so. So that's the way that a child begins to conceive heaven. And as an adult, perhaps you have a few more mature kinds of conceptions, but really, for most people, it's a continuation of what has already occurred in your lifetime. You see it as an extension. Perhaps you are free of pain. Perhaps you are wealthy or everything comes to you in an easy kind of a manner. But there's great difficulty in really knowing what that after death state is really all about. And as long as we are attached to this body and relegated to the five senses only, we can only extend into a heavenly consciousness what we have experienced here in body. Now, I'm not quite sure for people who have a hard time getting along with other people or carry grudges what they expect to happen. In an afterlife, perhaps they see their enemies as being down in the hot spot and they'll feel quite good about themselves and have a good laugh over what the other fellow's having to endure. Maybe that's heaven for them. And wouldn't that be true for somebody who has a vengeful kinds of consciousness? I want everybody to get what's coming to them. All the little hurts, all the little bruises that have happened along in life, I want to be sure that they get theirs. And once we stay attached to that kind of a notion, of course, we've signed up for that trip, for that journey then. And that doesn't happen in heavenly consciousness. That happens right here on earth. So if that karma, if that time to take to get one-upmanship or at least get even with somebody, we have to be there in order to see it. So we've just relegated ourselves to more lifetimes until that gets fulfilled. And it is interesting that when we stay attached like that, that we attach ourselves most oftentimes to the people we have the hardest time getting along with. And we consign ourselves to that kind of a future. It's a very interesting thing when you think about it. That really, to become free means to let go of our attachments of what we think ought to be. Let go of all thoughts of vengeance, as in the Old Testament it says, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." Let the law of karma, let God take care of it. Knowing that whatever is set into motion here on earth has to be fulfilled. So the real freedom that we're speaking about is not just merely an extension of this human consciousness and seeing us get our just deserts, whether we deserve them or not perhaps, but we see ourselves as having everything given to us and that would be heaven to us. But rather, heaven is of a different nature. Jesus said that, "Behold, the kingdom of heaven is within you." Now this is really interesting because once you begin to establish that the kingdom of heaven is within you, you can easily analyze yourself to see whether you're experiencing heaven. Are you experiencing heaven within yourself or not? And what we can easily see in this earthly incarnation is that we experience hell in our own selves. We can also experience great happiness. What most people haven't really endeavored upon is experiencing heaven. Because heaven is a very definite state of awareness, a state of consciousness. It is a state of consciousness that is different from the ordinary working state of the mind and the body. When we go within, because that's the only place to find it, is within ourselves. Of course, the first thing we're assaulted with is all the things that occupy our ordinary life. And so we're tempted, so to speak, with all of these thoughts, all of these preoccupations of the mind. If we're successful in escaping the gravity of some of these thoughts and preoccupations of our immediate world, what comes next? It comes the things of our past, the unresolved feelings, the fears, the desire nature, all the things that lie deep within the subconscious mind. And if we are able to endure all of that and pass through all of that, through having our mantra, through having our meditation, through having a focus of mind upon God, then gradually, gradually, the mind is purified and we are uplifted in experience. And what happens in that upliftment? Well, there are times, because there are things that not only earlier in this lifetime are unresolved in the subconscious mind, but there are things from past life association. And we don't have to go seeking out any of these past life associations, but in deeper meditation they come to us. Not for entertainment value, not just to titillate us, but because they want resolution. The resolution is that they still have some emotional charge of attraction or repulsion. And in my own experiences, I have had many, many of these kinds of revelations about past lifetimes. And it has been through some of those past life remembrances that I've also had past life remembrances of leaving the body in different incarnations. And what happens when the soul leaves that body? And what has been described by what are called near-death experiences correspond very well with what I experienced as I had these remembrances from times before. That you were lifted up. And in that upliftment, there was a great being of light. Now, Mother said, it's easy to project that this is some outer Christ that is sitting with you, but actually it's your own inner Christ that is sitting with you. And you look back over your lifetime. You see everything. There's nothing that can be hidden in that moment, no more than it could be hidden from your own consciousness. And you see your whole life unfold before you. And with that light of being with you, you look at it with wisdom. You look at it with compassion. You look at it with understanding. You see where errors that you have made were made, where you strayed off, where you made mistakes, where you went against the laws of nature and of the soul. You understand it easily in that moment, better, perhaps, than you ever did while living. The sentence or the judgment that comes is not, in a sense, coming from an outside source. It's coming from your own knowledge. It's coming from your own soul's wisdom, which you know to be true deep in your heart. And when you go against those laws, you feel an inner pain for the things that you did. If you acted meanly towards people or out of ignorance or you held on to grudges and anger, if you wasted opportunities, if you were stingy, if you didn't serve, if you didn't give, it causes a pain deep in your heart. It's not anybody punishing you. It's you feeling the pain of your own misapprehension of truth, of reality, of the truth of your soul. You also see those things that you did well, those moments when you behaved well, those things that stand out in your consciousness as moments of learning. And you find out, as the Dr. Moody, who wrote the Near-Death Experiences, he said the two primary themes that seemed to come across to people who had had near-death experiences and they had reviewed their life, where there were two themes that seemed to stand out to many. And that was, how much did you love and how much did you learn? And I think that this is a wonderful way to analyze our lives. Are we learning from our experience? Are we taking advantage of what we came here to do and to learn about? And do we open our hearts? Do we love? Do we learn to love? Do we have an ever-expanding circle of love, as Swami Satchidananda once described as knowing how to know whether we're having progress as a soul or not in realization. Is our circle of love ever expanding? Now, these two things entail quite a bit, and they cover a lot of ground when it comes to us living our lives. All of us come with things to learn. We come with those things that stand out most in our mind. Now, if you get quiet in the mind and settle down some of the noise of everyday life, I think you'll know what those things are that you have come to learn, some of the most essential ones at least. And so, to focus on those things, all of us have lots of things, lots of demands upon us. And you might call these details of life. And some of us get completely absorbed into the details of life. How do I earn a living? How do I get along with the people that I live around? How do I get myself from one place to another? All of these things are the details of life. And then there are the important things of life. There are those things that stand out to us as really having much more importance than the details. They're the things of family. They're the things of friendship. They're the things of service in this world. How do we serve other people? Are we growing in this life, or do we tend to be constricted? And the third category are the essential things in life. Now, these may number very few in your life, but these are the really essential ones that if you live through this life and do not tend towards these few essential things, you will really feel that you have wasted your life while here on earth. So this is a way to begin to analyze your own life, to really understand what are those few essential things that are absolute musts in this lifetime for you to deal with, to tend to give energy to. And you know, many times people put those essential tasks, maybe because they seem so big, they put them off a little bit. They want a special time for them. They think that they can't deal with those essential things when they're having to deal with all the little details of life. But if they let the details of life consume them, they will come to a time when it's too late to deal with those essentials. It will have passed them by. And the same with the important things. I was once to a planning seminar where they planning your time. And he said, if I wanted to take a look at what is really important to you, he says, I would look two places. He said, I would look at your daily calendar, your planner, if you have one, and how you spend the days of your life, how you spend the hours of your life. And he said, I'd look at your checkbook. And those two things would tell me what are really important in your life. And it's kind of an interesting way to take a look at how you prioritize the things in your life. What stands out as the most important? And are you tending towards those essential things? Are you really giving time and effort to those important things? Or is your life consumed with details, which you might even call non-essentials, although in the day-to-day maintenance of life, they are important things, but they have to be put into perspective. You have to take time, and it would be good to do at least on a daily basis. It would be good to take time to really analyze your life, to put your life in order. What if the cosmic hand of time came due today, and you were taken from this life, and this physical body should drop like a lump of clay that it is without the life force that sustains it, which is brought by the soul? How would you feel about the priorities that you have set? Would you feel right about the way that you've conducted your life and spent your time? It's a sobering thought, and it's not meant to bring gloom on you or to make you feel bad about yourself or about your life. It's just simply put out there to sharpen and crystallize what are those things that are important and what are those few essential things in life that if you were to leave this body, you see, there's something about life, and I think it comes from the soul, because the soul knows that it is eternal. But there's something inside of us that feels like that life will just continue, and it will never come to an end, and it will just kind of go on the way that it goes on. And we have to come to terms with the fact that this temple not made with hands, this human body, came into creation, and it will just as surely come to a time when it is no longer here. You think of the vast majority of humanity that lives and that has lived, the vast majority of bodies that have lived are no longer here. Just a tiny fragment of all those that have ever lived are living in this moment. And yet there's something in our consciousness that seems to shield us from this simple fact. I think it's very noteworthy that the Buddha had the revelation before he became the Buddha, when he was still Siddhartha Gautama, and he was still a prince and was destined, according to his father, to become a king. And Siddhartha was traveling along in a carriage, and he saw three different people. Now, he had been shielded from anything that might be disturbing to him due to a prophecy that he could become a wandering mendicant and a sage and a saint. And his father didn't want that for him. He wanted him to be a king. Naturally, he wanted him to follow in his own footsteps. But somehow, these three bodies appeared as he traveled along in the carriage, and he asked his carriage driver to stop. And he said, "What is that?" He said he had never seen anybody looking like that. They had sores. They were moaning and groaning with pain. They were obviously not feeling well. And the driver said, "That is sickness." And Siddhartha asked, "Has that happened for everybody?" "Yes, for everybody, even kings." So they went on and they saw another man. He's also laying by the road. And he was all wrinkled up and slumped over, and he had difficulty walking, and he was shaky. And Siddhartha asked, what is his problem here?" "Sire, that is old age." "Does old age happen to everyone?" "Yes, to everyone, even to kings." And then finally they came upon a man who is stone cold dead, lying next to the road. And he said, "What is this? He has no breath. He seems to have no life at all." "This is death, sire." "Does it happen to everyone?" "Yes, it happens to everyone, even to kings." And so it sent the Buddha on a long journey, a journey of realization. He left everything. He left his wife, his newborn son, his father, his kingdom, everything. He wandered for 7 years, practicing severe austerities, disciplines of the body, trying to gain this realization. Nothing availed. Nothing gave him the kind of wisdom and insight that he was looking for. Finally, after 7 years, he quit that life after hearing a musician talk about the strings on the guitar, and that if the strings are too taut, they'll snap and break. And if they're too loose, that you won't get any sound out of them. That they just have to be adjusted just right. And he realized that he had been stringing his guitar string of the body too tight with all these severe disciplines. And that he wasn't honoring the body. He needed a healthy body in order to get his realization. And so he took some food and he took some water from the nearby villagers. When his fellow wandering mendicants saw this, they thought he had fallen from the path, so they left. But he didn't mind. He knew what he knew from inside of himself. And he went and he sat underneath the Bodhi tree. And there he sat, and he just determined within himself, even though he had fed the body and he had gotten it strong again, he had determined, I'm going to sit here until I die if necessary, but I have to realize this truth. I have to go beyond this body and know what it is to exist in some superior state, because just to lead a life until you get sick, you get old and you die, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. I've got to. Something inside of him knew that there was an answer to what he was so deeply disturbed about. And so he dove deeper and deeper, and he penetrated down through different layers, and he had different temptations come up along the way. Temptations of the body and the senses and of sex. Temptations of power, temptations of fear. And he persevered through all of them. He had a strong, determined mind. And gradually all of those things cleared. And when they cleared, then he became enlightened. He transcended the body. He came into soul consciousness. Into nirvana. Into a state of self or God realization. And in that state, he knew who he truly was. He knew that he was not just simply the body. He was more than the body, much more than the body. He was a supreme soul. And he found there his oneness with the divine consciousness that is the author of everything that is. Now he knew this through his own realization. He didn't need to read it in a book. He didn't need to hear it from somebody else. He knew it, and he knew that he knew, as Mother says. And this was a great moment for humanity. Because through the realization of this one great God being came a transformation of the world, came a means when he first came back down into more a human state of consciousness out of the pure spiritual state. He now was aware of both the spiritual state and his state as a human body as well. And this is a state that great masters can come to. Is that they're not only aware of themselves as pure spiritual essence, they're also aware that they have and inhabit a particular body. And they're able to operate through that body. Now, if the mind is not properly prepared for this, it would come across as a schizophrenic type experience, because you would feel that you are a part of all people, everybody, all creation, and you would feel that you are a particular person. And both can coincide. To the human mind, that seems an impossibility because it operates in subject-object manner. In other words, there always has to be an individual I relating to other things, objects, or people. In divine consciousness, human consciousness, this is no longer true. Divine consciousness, you can be experiencing your oneness with creation. You can be experiencing your communion and connection with people. You can feel at times that you are actually those people operating through them. You are a witness to what they're experiencing. There are no barriers any longer because you are one with that divine consciousness. That is the state that Jesus came to as well. And he knew that he was one with all humanity, so that he could say that whenever you served anyone, no matter what a lowly state that individual may be, no matter how impoverished, no matter what their circumstances, they may be in prison. But by serving them, you have served me. Because he realized that he was part and parcel with everyone who lived. Can you imagine such a thing? That you feel your union, your communion with all humanity in this way. You cannot cut your heart off from anybody. And even those who are living in ignorance and acting out of that ignorance, you are also one with them. Now, of course, the human mind comes up and says, but I'm not that. I don't do those kinds of things that this person does out of ignorance. Nevertheless, you have a communion and a union with them, as you do with all creation. And as long as the human mind is operating and making judgments that I am not that, then you will still stay relegated to the human consciousness. But when you open yourself and feel yourself to be in communion with all creation, there are no such barriers. Now you have entered into a divine consciousness, a divine consciousness. And this is a wonderful state of being to be in. I would like to read here from an excerpt from a book on Dr. Lewis called Treasures Against Time. And this is an introduction, I believe, by John Rosser, who is his son-in-law, I believe. Some 30 years after Doctor's first meeting with Paramahansa Yogananda, the great guru, that is, master, entered Mahasamadhi. He left the body. That night, a heavy rain fell in Los Angeles. It was very dark and stormy, somewhat reminiscent of Jesus' death, when the earth became dark and quaked. As you can imagine, those close to the guru were very shaken at his death. Devotees were driven into worship and meditation by their grief. But God does not deny those drawn to his pure instrument. And so he appeared as the guru to several while they were deep in their reveries. Doctor knew of these visions and wondered why he, having known the guru more intimately and longer than any of the rest, was deprived of the master's vision. Nevertheless, he continued his meditations. One night, while deep in meditation, a great light filled his inner forehead. Doctor was taken back by its brilliance until he heard a voice soft like murmuring clouds, which spoke from within that light and said, "It was I who came to you as your beloved master." Isn't that beautiful? These kinds of inner confirmations come, and they don't always come exactly when we want them to. But if we make the effort and we really dedicate ourselves to the path of realization, it is not a narrow sectarian path that we dedicate ourselves to. It is not that we are right and all else are wrong. Nothing of the sort. But in order to advance and make progress, we have to learn to dedicate ourselves in a single-minded purpose. This is true for any great accomplishment in this world, and it is most importantly true for our own spiritual path. And so when we do this, we go beyond what the body can tell us. It's useless when it comes to knowing about what is beyond the body. We go beyond what the mind can tell us. The mind, too, is relegated to the body. And it cannot tell us. other than reading about in second-hand ways what others may have experienced of what is beyond this body. It is only by direct experience, going deep into the laboratories of our own souls, that we can know the truth, that we can really be satisfied deep in our souls. I would like to read one other thing that's entitled The Guru-Disciple Relationship out of this book of Treasures Against Time. This is Dr. Lewis. Now we come to the guru-disciple friendship. This is the greatest thing, because this is the direct route to God through divine love, through God's unconditional love. It is a spiritual law, and I know a great many of you here have that relationship. You have that relationship because you want that unconditional love. And with that love, you give divine love. You stir up a great flame of spirit because of the love which you have within yourself and with your guru. And by that love, by the guru-disciple relationship, you help others. You set the example for others to follow back home to God. Master told me, let your life be an example for others to follow, where all will meet who live and do right. Who set the example? He set the example, which I have tried to follow. That's the greatest friendship, because that's the spiritual law. And see what happens? Both go to God. Let that be the bond in your spiritual friendship. The greatest is the guru-disciple relationship, because what is the spiritual law of the guru-disciple relationship? The guru introduces his friend to God. He introduces his friend to the friend of all friends, that one eternal Father. That's the greatest relationship. That's the most wonderful thing. In the autobiography, I read a little bit about such a friendship, which I should like to give you at this time. The friendship between the guru and the disciple, between Sri Yukteswar and his disciple, our master, Paramahansa Yogananda. You remember when the Master first met Sri Yukteswar. Sri Yukteswar told him, I give you my unconditional love. Will you give me the same unconditional love? The Master said, I will love you eternally, Gurudev. Ordinary love is selfish, darkly rooted in desires and satisfactions. Divine love is without condition, without change. The flux of the human heart is gone forever. That's the restlessness of ordinary life at the transfixing touch of pure love. He added humbly, and this is the greatness of Sri Yukteswarji speaking to his disciple. Why could he speak to him that way? Because through his disciple Paramahansa Yogananda, he saw God. For this is what he said, if ever you find me falling from the state of God realization, please promise to put my head on your lap and help bring me back to the cosmic beloved we both worship. That is divine love, unconditioned. I used to go to the Master with my head hanging down, ashamed of the many things I did. He would make no show of anything. Come on in, he would say. That's divine, unconditional love. That's what you must have for your friend. You must feel within your friend the presence of God. And never betray a friend, for that is the greatest sin. Worse than murder is betrayal of a friend. The guru-disciple relationship is the greatest relationship to demonstrate the one true love, divine love. And so my true friend was our master. These things are difficult to speak about, and it is unnecessary to speak about them. He knows whom he let knows. He knows whom God lets know. You will know when God lets you know. In true friendship, like the guru-disciple relationship, each knows. Just like when you feel the presence of God, you know. And no one can take it away from you, because there is divine love in it. I will read to you to express that from one of Master's letters to me to show you and perhaps point out to you just that true friendship and divine love. He wrote this from Phoenix in 1930. God, I care not for riches, nor for fame or pomp, but give me true friends, even just one, if it be through whom I may behold Thee, and whom I may trust and enjoy without, as Thine image, air reflected in the mirror of my love. Ah, wavelets, wavelets of true friendship, heaven-born, merge in Thy one ocean of vast love, in the sea of friendship, the meandering, lost, and prodigal souls come back to their own one home. Can there be greater friend than that? That's an example of divine friendship. So let us be ever focused upon the essentials, first and foremost of all. And for myself, I know that the one essential is my God realization. For all other happiness is contained within that one happiness. And without that one happiness, there is no other happiness that is worth having. To have that one friendship, beyond all other friendships, I count most highly. But then to have that friendship through all other friends, to see God in all other friends, to feel His love, to feel His presence within human friendship, is a most wonderful, wonderful thing. And I value it as I value nothing else, as Master said here. So let us not ever lose sight of the true and lasting values and goals for which we have come. When we see the death of another and honor their life, let it be a reminder that one day that will be us as well. And that when we breathe this last breath, and we let that breath out and expands out into spirit and our consciousness with it, that we do not look back even for a moment with regret. But we look back with gratitude, with thanksgiving, with a feeling of fulfillment because we did what we came to do. We put the things that were most important first and didn't relegate them just for another day, just for another day, always another day. It's an easy habit to get into, but it's a deadly habit. So I thank you for your love and your prayers and your support. I can tell you that with the Christmas cards and gifts and things that came this time of year, I'm just completely humbled and in awe of those who give their love, their material support for this work, for what we do here. It truly is humbling to me, and I think that I have done nothing at all, and yet God has seen fit for that. I think, as St. Paul said, that everything, if it does not have love, is just a tinkling bell. It has no real meaning. Love, in the final analysis, is the true substance of this creation. For us to discover that treasure lying deep in the heart, the treasure of love for God, the treasure of love for God and all people, to find true and lasting friends. These is the true wealth that will satisfy us throughout all eternity. You please all pray with me. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of Thy glorious presence.
Of Thy thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
I bow to the light within you all.